Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, how you doing out there? Andrew Horowitz here. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and it is episode number 154, coming to the home stretch of the first quarter of 2010. March, in fact, towards the end, coming in like a, lion, I suppose, for the markets. We'll see how it ends, hopefully not out like a lamb. Nonetheless, we have some great things lined up for you today. I have a wonderful, just a tremendous guest that is going to be joining us today. His name is John Molden. And yes, you asked for it, and we get it. We had a lot of calls and questions saying, Andrew, get this guy on. So we did. We tracked him down. We brought him on. John Molden will be here shortly talking about markets, all sorts of different things. I did some research on him. Didn't know a lot about him beforehand, but you know what? Got to know him a bit. Nice guy from a couple of phone calls we did prior. And we'll see what happens when we give a call to him today. Some of the things we'll talk about, I'm sure, at least in some pretty interesting directions. We're also going to have a question about currencies that we had a call in, and we're going to try to, you know, kind of ramp up those call-ins and those questions that come in, put them on the show from a listener. We're going to actually talk about the stochastics screen that we did about 2 weeks ago and talk about the results there, some of the market issues, talk about some China, we'll talk about the Eurozone, a rant that I probably am going to go off on about the whole European region, something that I wanted to get off my chest this week on the DH Unplugged show, but I couldn't, and I'll tell you why. We didn't actually do a show this week, and I'll tell you why that was in a second, which relates to the next point, which is my birthday weekend. And thank you so much for all the cards and well wishes that I received. Virtual cards. Nobody sends out cards anymore, I don't think. More, Facebook happy birthdays and email happy birthdays and things like that. Thank you so much for everybody that did. Of course, that was last week. 45 years old. Oh, man, I'm getting old. But I went to New Orleans, as you know. A couple interesting things happened there. One of the things that went red fishing, got some great red fish. I'll try to put a picture of one of the red fish we caught up on the site, and I'll write that down, as a matter of fact, right now. And then what we also did was went to some great restaurants, Commander's Palace. I went to the Camellia Grill, and anybody familiar with New Orleans, you know all about those. We did also went to the World War II Museum, D-Day Museum. I highly encourage you to do that. I went to the IMAX, went on a Segway tour. That was a blast. But one of the greatest things was one night we went to the Acme Oyster House down on right off of Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. And I sat down right at the front of the bar, the Oyster Bar. My son and I, we sat down. And just above us was the webcam, the Oyster Cam, they call it. And I said, hey, this will be kind of fun. I'll do a little Twitter tweet and tell everybody, hey, here I am. So I kind of punched it in. I'm here I am at the Oyster Bar. Check out the Oyster Bar, acmeoyster.com webcam. And, you know, you'll see me on it right now. And I waved hello. And about 5 minutes later, I got this manager that came over to me and said, excuse me, are you Andrew Horowitz? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, we've gotten like a dozen phone calls of all these people that want to buy you drinks. I said, really? You got to be kidding me. I said, that's terrific. He said, not really. I said, well, why is that? He said, well, we can't take credit card orders over the phone. I said, oh, man, you are a buzzkill fella. I mean, we're in New Orleans where things are supposedly very big and very easy, but yet at the same time kind of loose, but they couldn't do it. So anyway, thank you so much for all those wonderful thoughts and trying to buy me oysters and drinks at the bar. Your thoughts and well wishes are very much, very, very much taken in here, and it was very great to do that on my birthday evening. The other thing is I got a little sick on the way back. I don't know whether I ate something bad or whether I just caught a cold from those cramped and very isolated airlines. And on the way back, kind of the next day, I felt really lousy, had a fever for a couple of days, and I was unable to do the DH Unplugged. We kept on postponing it. So, but the other thing I want to mention for my birthday weekend was thank you so much. And a thank you, this is the other point, for everybody who participated so far in the Jason Taylor Reading Room. We're not going to talk much about that till we have him on the next. We're going to actually have Jason on and talking about a variety of things and talking about the area of finance and the professional athlete. I think that would be a kind of a cool topic because we've worked with some professional athletes, and it's a little bit of a different situation, more of a compact career, if you will, in terms of when their earnings power is. And it gives a little insight, I think, for all of us on you know, how things are a little bit different there. And yeah, they have a lot more money they make oftentimes. But anyway, we'll get into that with him. But anyway, anybody that participated, thank you so much. There's still opportunities. We're running this for a couple of months, for a couple more months. If you want to give, $10, $20, $30 donation, if you ever got a great stock tip here or not, you get a little enjoyment on the weekly basis. Please, I encourage you wholeheartedly right now, before you forget, go give something to the Jason Taylor Reading Room. It's a great, great initiative. You'll find out more on the website at thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes. Click the button, donate now, get a tax deduction, feel good about yourself. And, that's something that I really appreciate. And again, thank you so much for all your great birthday well wishes. All right, before we get to our guest here, I thought I'd talk about a few things. Where to begin? Let's talk about China a little bit. China's been clamping down on their lending, so they say, and there's, they don't want the properties to overheat. We've seen a little bit of a divergence between Hong Kong and China markets of late. Hong Kong's been holding up really well. Their pollution is increasing tremendously. They can't even go outside last week. Did you see the story? If you were in Hong Kong, they suggest don't go outside for a few days because the pollution is just so god-awful. Kind of like the Mexican city syndrome they've had in China's situation we've seen before as well. Now, what I wanted to mention, though, was that China is clamping down just, I think maybe this weekend also, they talked about just how they're going to clamp down even further on restricting banks from lending and making sure that loans only go out to developers that actually have land in development, which is probably a good idea. They don't want any more inflationary pressures coming. There's been a lot of demands by the U.S. and other countries around the world for the yuan, which is their currency, to start floating. We'll talk about that when we answer the question on the back end of the show that a listener called in about. But what's happening now is there's a lot of finger pointing, and we're starting to really get a little stupid, in my opinion. Senators are getting a little bit ahead of themselves, trying to kind of do what they can to boost exports as they think that's really necessary, which it is, to increase the GDP and the overall, economic expansion of the U.S., and they want it to come from China. And China is like, what are you talking about? We're trying to fix our own situation here, and what they're doing is they're essentially, doing what they can in their environment to, of course, protect themselves and to do what they can to make sure that their situation is, the best that it can be. So now at the same time, now China's, going at us and we're going at them and we're having this little trade war and it's just starting to heat up. And that's just a really bad thing, in my opinion. The Chinese markets we are concerned about, we're not totally, saying we're not going to invest there. We actually like the Hong Kong market and we're going to stick with them for some time. But I think that when we look at the overall impact of what the Chinese are doing right now, there is the potential for a global slowdown on the heels of this. Not right now, but at least a cooling off period, because a lot of the loose monetary policy is starting to be stripped out. We saw that India just last week raised their key interest rate. There's a lot of talk in the U.S. about key interest rates starting to inch up. We saw Fed Honeg, of course, say that he would like to see that the interest rate starting to move up sooner than later to try to choke off some of the excess potential inflationary environment that we'll see. Bonds took this very badly last week. Bonds were moving along just nicely and yields were down. All of a sudden, we saw two different issues. The 5-year and the 7-year auction of the treasuries in the early and late part of the week that were really not well received. The bid to cover ratios were low. The high yield was much higher than anticipated. And if you notice, the bond market sold off dramatically. Now, also at the same time, we saw major reversals on the equity indices. Now, what happened there? Well, that was a combination of the fact that we started to hit a little bit of a frothy blow-off top, it looks like, on much of the indices, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. We talked last week with a fellow from Behind the Numbers who talked about shorting Starbucks. Great call by him, by the way. And, at that time, we talked about what was going on with earnings estimates and when a company met their price target, instead of a company saying, okay, that's great, we're going to see where they go from now, they simply just increased their target again, even though there may be no fundamental basis for that. Well, with all this being said and all the kind of animal spirits out there and the risk trade on right now, we saw the dollar come up, and this is the whole point about Greece that we need to talk about, and Portugal and Spain and the whole Eurozone and the London and England with their pound. It's very sneaky, very sneaky. The pound has been dropping like a rock. We've all been focusing on the euro so much that maybe I think many people have really not seen what's going on with the pound. It is absolutely horrible looking. Take a look at the chart between the dollar pound. It is nasty. I mean, the pound is just getting pummeled. Why? It's because there is a major debt problem, very similar to what we have here. Their debt issuance is obnoxious to a point that their debt service is becoming so ridiculous, and which is really the problem with Greece right now. Now, let's just kind of refocus. I really do want to focus on what's going on with Greece. I've talked about this many times, and what I have seen is just absolute rhetoric coming out of Germany and France and the overall EU, Sarkozy, Merkel, and just this whole ridiculous event that they're creating only for one purpose. And so that Greece can, in a month from now, issue about $10 billion of new notes to pay off the debt they have coming due. They're going to do everything in their power to increase investor confidence, whether they lie or not, twist and fake or whatever they have to do to say there's going to be maybe something in the backing and postpone it to the very last second so they can redo and postpone and kick the can down the road on this Greek debt. And that's a big problem. You know, we're finding that, we're questioning right now, you know, what is the real problem, the depth here? Because really, Germany doesn't want to participate in this. They have said it outright. France is saying, really, this is a bad situation. And a very, very bad situation. The EU is really not interested in breaking their rules on what they did to create the euro. And what's happening now is it's almost having to happen on a regular basis. Now, what I find the most interesting about this is that when you look at the circumstance here with Greece, we have like Spain chiming in saying, hey, I just want to let you know, the EU is not going to allow anybody to fail. And here's what really pisses me off. Spain is kind of like somewhere second or third in line here. Look what happened with Portugal last week. They were downgraded by Fitch. Their credit rating was actually downgraded. And this is what is occurring, which our government doesn't want to see. The outright devastation, the outright ridiculousness of the continual spending, not to mention the healthcare bill and the financial bailouts and the housing bailouts that we saw on Friday, and the continuation of this spend at any means, this horrible level of and disregard of the future is so concerning that you have to consider what's going to be happening. And what's going to be happening is clearly an inflationary environment. There's no question about that. We have some gold positions that we like. They're fluctuating and moving around, and right now the dollar is moving them lower than it probably should be because of the flight to safety when it comes to Greece. But you know what? The dollar is just probably the better out of the worst. That's what's going on right now. And I got to tell you something. I don't know where the end is here. I don't know what the end is going to be. I don't know what the end game is going to be. But the debt factor that we have and the debt load that we have, if interest rates start going up right now and the requirements that we have and what they're attempting to do and why they're trying to push things in right now so hard is very concerning. China is starting to slow down in their buying of our treasuries. I don't blame them one bit. Do you? I mean, how do you blame them? We're looking ridiculous. We need to slow down the spending. And what's going to happen on the back end is we are going to be a nation very much like those technically Eastern European that just can't get out of their debt. And I don't see any kind of cure for this. What's the result? The result is not good. You know this. You know this down deep that this is not a good situation. We do see that, you know, countries that have this problem, let's just look at Japan, do not come out of recessionary environments for decades. Decades. Until we stop the spending. That's what has to happen. It will hurt. Be painful. We got to stop supporting everything and everybody and focusing in on cleaning up our balance sheets and getting our act together like a real business. If the United States was a business, investors would look at them as reckless and say, I'm not buying. That will happen. That's going to happen. That is happening. All right, let's skip on over, and I want to talk a little bit about the stochastic screen that we run. We had this screen that we said is a purely technical screen, and it looks at stochastics turning up. Let me go find that here. Here we go. All right, so what do we have? We had, first of all, of that screen, We want to take out the ETFs that were the doubles and all that, because that's something that, you know, you can look at, but we want to look at the individual stocks. We had BJ's and C.H. Robertson. I put these up there a couple of weeks ago. Shonda Games, Helmerich & Payne, Palm. There's about six or seven different companies there. We only actually invested in one of those. We invested in Schweitzer Maudit, which is a company that really fell from grace pretty hard about 2 months ago when there was a potential for a class action lawsuit. A patent infringement. Pardon me. It was a patent and trademark infringement on them. They make papers for cigarette companies, etc. What happened there was we saw that the overall the setup on the stock was that we saw a stochastic turning up. We saw a very significant amount of support at the number before we bought into it, and that stock is up about 4-4.5% since we did. In the same time period, the markets are up about 1% or so. There were some really good things. BJ's Wholesales was good, and a few others. There was a lot of pain. I mean, do you see what happened with, for example, Palm? Oh man, their earnings stunk it up, but good. Down 30% in that same period. Palm. I don't know what really they have to offer in competing with the iPhone and the BlackBerry and the variety of different Google Nexus and other Google type and other smartphones out there. Obviously not much. Anyway, I want to share that with you. I put a chart on the website that has the actual performance of these. But, you know, when we do these and you look at these types of screens and you look at what to invest in here, you got to look at not only the screen but where the stock's, you know, rocket point would be. And I thought it was interesting, and it kind of we only actually did as a company for our clients invest in one of these stocks. And also on DH Unplugged, we recommended one of these as well. So just consider that. Something as a follow-up from 2 weeks ago, I think it was. What else do we want to talk about before we got to John? Let's see. I think the only thing that we want to talk about here is directionally where we're going. I want to make sure that you go and look at the indicators that we're watching. This is a Monday morning, first thing in the morning, look at the week ahead, and we post that on the Disciplined Investor blog, disciplineinvestor.com. Check that out, and you'll see some of the things we talk about, direction of overbought, oversold conditions, gold, silver combinations, Baltic Dry Index. We look at the long bond, and we look at just a variety of different indices and very, very specialized and we'll call it customized indicators that we've created that we look at on a regular basis over the weekends and into Monday. And I think this will be important for you to take a look at. Make sure you get that. Of course, you can just make sure to get yourself hooked up on Twitter, on our email, and you'll get that automatically. But nonetheless, that's something I think you should look at. Let's go and bring in, I don't know if I missed anything. If it did, we'll pick it up after we talk with John Malden. And let's kind of get into that conversation, and let's hook it up. Let's kind of take a quick second, and we'll change the gear around and get the phone call working, give a call in. When we get back, we'll talk with John Malden, who I think you're going to enjoy. He's a very smart guy, and I encourage you to listen hard to what he has to say. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, so we have a special guest, somebody who I think you all pretty much know, but have asked me to have on for some time. I got a lot of emails from people saying, you got to get this guy on. He's great. So we did so. We gave him a call. He was kind enough to join us. John Malden is his name. He's an author. He is an interesting individual when it comes to the financial markets because he talks about things as it is, doesn't hold back very much from what I can read and what I can see. And I want to thank him very much for being with us here today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. It's good to be here.
Well, great. So I thought we'd talk about, we'll start out a little slowly. We'll go back to your book back in 2004, where you talked about how the idea was that buy and hold was dead. That's how you started your book. You came up with this idea that the whole idea, this back in 2004, mind you, let's make sure we say this correctly, that buy and hold is no longer going to be the thing. What was your thesis back then? Why 2004 when things were going well, almost to a point of kind of where we are today, right? It was right after the 2000 to 2002-ish, three, draw down the markets. Things were going fine. 2004 looked okay. And here you are, John Malden, saying buy and hold is dead.
Yes.
Now, who are you to say that?
Well,
I'm kidding. I'm also
in
the camp.
What I did in 2003 and 2004 was I started suggesting that the markets move in cycles. I mean, everybody talks about secular bears and secular bulls. But I argued back then that you shouldn't look at these secular bull and bear cycles in terms of the price of the stock, but rather the valuation of the stock. Now, once you started looking at valuations, these cycles became far more clear. They're an average of about 17 years, and they go from high valuations to low valuations back to high. There's never any stopping in the middle and turning around. And then you could see that we were in high valuations. 2004, we were starting to climb again. But we never got down to low valuations. We never got down to low single digits, 10, 11, or single digits, typically, which is what we go to. We were still chopping along well above the average. And I said, we're in a secular bear cycle. And in secular bear cycles, buy and hold is dead. In secular bull cycles, you absolutely want to buy and hold.
Right.
From 82 to 99, the best thing you could do was to buy and hold.
Right.
Don't blink, just buy.
Right, just buy and leave it and don't even look, and in a couple of years look back at it again.
Right, and mm-hmm. And so today we still have relatively high valuations. I mean, however you want to look at P/Es, we're above 20. That's above the long-term mean of 16. We haven't come back down yet. And so what that suggests is that just as we had a lost decade, you know, for the last decade, we could have another long period of time where we could see investors frustrated because markets could go back down again and they got to clog their way back up. But until we get to valuations, and you do that in two ways. Either the price can go down or earnings can go up and the price goes sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So in this particular, time frame, I'm arguing that it's a trader's market. And this could be that way, for another 7 years. Remember I said these cycles are for an average of 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we're anywhere close. I also wrote back in 2003 that we were going to need at least three recessions to get back to low valuations, because that's typically what does it. You just got to kind of sort things out. Well, we've had two.
Well, let me interrupt you. You said this in 2003, so did you count the recession of 2000 and 2002 in that?
Yeah, oh yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you counted that. That was your first. And then you said the next one, of course, is the one here.
We've just gone through the second one, and so we've got another one to go through that, typically would be what you would need to see valuations starting to come down to levels at which you start pounding the table to buy.
And that would be a washout. That would be the washout recession, right?
Well, it could be, but see, remember, we're not talking about price. It's just because go back to that 81, 82 recession, the price didn't go back to the bottom of 74.
Right.
Okay, we had a recession in the 70s, and, the late 60s, and then 74, and then another one in 80, 82. The price never went back down to the bottom. The bottom happened with the second recession, and we may have put in a generational low back March, but that didn't keep you from having a volatile market and valuations compressing for the next 8 years.
Right.
After that recession. So I mean, you would have had to have a real ironclad stomach to miss those 30% and 40% swings.
Right.
Down and back up. I mean, just everybody's seeing the charts, those were ugly.
You know what's interesting, John? What I find the most fascinating is that, we're in, let's talk about the last downswing of the markets and how severe it was and how, we did see possibly generational lows, et cetera. A lot of it's being blamed on the timing of hedge funds having to get out and the forced selling that went on, all these different things that went on. What I find the most fascinating about that story is it really possible that every country in the world, every stock market was unloaded by hedge funds across the board like that? Was it really that plausible, or was it something else going on? Why was it so well timed this time around? And I think, let me fast forward here, that you have another, by the way, the book we were talking about in 2004 was it was called Bullseye Investing, right? The one that you had that was called is it called Generational Wave? That's from what, 2007?
It's not my book.
That wasn't your book. Oh, you know what? That's because you're you know what? But you do subscribe to some of that discussion, right?
That well, sure. I that's mean, what I'm talking about. I mean, there is that. There's a lot of waves and generational moves, and it's a complicated thing. I mean, one of the things I'm writing right now is I'm writing a letter to my kids, and it'll be in my e-letter this week because I've been writing about Greece and the velocity of money and Fed policy, and you know, it's a free letter, so I have 1.5 million readers, and your readers can just Google John Malden, our listeners can just Google John Malden and go get it. But I'm going to write a letter to my kids because they've asked me, said, Dad, what does this mean for us?
Yep.
Why do we care about Greece? And the answer is, you care because everything's connected. And that's what we found out in 2007 and 2008, that subprime mortgages in California, you know, threatened to bring the entire world system down.
Right.
It's kind of, because it's, everything was connected, because we were, what happened was it reduced the liquidity of a number of different funds, not just hedge funds, but all kinds of money managers all over the world. And there was a flight to safety. There was a flight for liquidity. Everybody was leveraged to the gills. And so in those type of crises, you don't sell what you want to sell. You sell what you can sell.
Right. Forced selling was a big issue.
And so everything starts going down. Then you get more margin calls. And yep. It just starts feeding on each other. That's the nature of a crisis.
So give me a little hint, because my kids have been asking also what it means. And I've tried to go with the knee bones connected to the hip bone, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. Or I've also talked about how, you know, what's the difference if you don't have a kidney? What's the big deal about a kidney? Well, let me explain what the kidney does and how it relates to other things in your body. And then that relates to other things also, I mean, and that's what you're talking about here with Greece. And I think you're using Greece as a metaphor for the bigger picture, whether it's Greece, Portugal, whether it's a subprime crisis, whether it's, this new health care bill, whatever it is.
It is, because, I mean, Greece, I'll have to go back and check, but it's like 350 billion euros. I mean, that's dollars. So it's an obscene amount of money. And then the bulk of that is in German and French and then kind of scattered around the rest of the EU banks. Well, if Greece defaults, you know, are they going to mark that debt to zero? Or is that clearly is going to affect their liquidity? Well, that means that they're going to have less money to lend. That means those companies are going to buy less from us and the country. If it's a contraction, it probably creates another recession in Europe. We'll have knock-on effects here because it'll be another credit crisis. Will it be bad enough that banks stop lending to each other and we see LIBOR spreads break out, and then we become even banks become even tighter?
Now.
In the future than they are now,
right,
which is
right.
Already pretty tight.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, well, that means small businesses have trouble getting loans. That means that we're not going to be able to get the job creation that we need, and that's why I tell my son's at UPS, that's why you're not getting enough hours and you didn't get promoted to driver even though you were senior, because people stopped shipping packages.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter works at one of the local bars and they're down 15% because it's a crank out at a trendy place, and all of her friends are losing their jobs.
Yeah.
And so they can't drink as much as they did. And, my other son works in an electronics store and his commissions are way down because they're not buying electronics. So all of these things have an effect, because the credit in the finance system is kind of the circulation for the blood,
right?
And it's the blood in the system, and when we start talking about reducing that, I mean, that's why the taxes matter. I mean, your taxes, none of my kids' taxes are probably going to go up because they're not in the $250,000 plus, but it's going to make a difference because tax cuts have a multiplier. I mean, tax increases and tax cuts have a multiplier effect, And that's going to reduce GDP next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduction, in fact, could put us back into another recession or very, very slow growth when we've already got 10% unemployment. And all of that's connected.
Yeah.
I mean, and what happens is so many of our leaders, in Congress right now, don't see the connections. Christina Romer, who's Barack Obama's chairwoman of the National Council of Economic Advisors, she and her husband, Paul, did this, impressive, massive study here a few years ago showing that tax cuts have a 3x multiplier. Tax increases have a 3x multiplier. But on average, people just kind of, in Congress, they're just walking away and ignoring that. Well, it's going to have an effect. It's all connected.
It's interesting. I think that one of the big things that really troubles me right now is the whole idea that Congress seems to be, they're very focused on fixing the problem without care of what problems they create, right? That's first of all. The second thing that's truly concerning is, let me give you a prediction here. The Greece thing is not, and I say this seriously, they will not let them default. It would cost them too much money in all sorts of ways. They would rather spend it through propping up, even though Germany is not happy, let's just state that point. Sarkozy is not so happy, but a little bit less, aggravated than Merkel, obviously. And I think that there's no choice that they have to do this. The problem with it is, and back to your connections discussion, is that if they do this for, they do this for Greece, what about Spain? Spain's already with the banner saying, hey, we are committed to helping Greece and other countries that need help in the eurozone. I'm like, well, wait a minute, Spain. You're the next in line here right after Portugal. So you're
right. I mean, Portugal's smaller than Greece. Portugal. I mean, it's kind of like if somebody says, well, what happens if Connecticut defaults? I mean, would anybody care? And the answer is, well, probably not. But that's a whole lot different in the eurozone when so much of that debt is sitting at banks,
right?
Who bought that debt and put it on their books because they've got something like 40x leverage in Europe. And so, with 40x leverage, if you can get 3% on your money,
beautiful.
That's not a bad return. Right. You can make some profits on it. And they were allowed to hold that debt because Greek is AAA. You don't, or was, so, you could hold that debt on your books and only take a small haircut.
Right.
So now all of a sudden if 2% or 3% of your assets are Greek debt and you're leveraged 40-1, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. So what's going to happen? I mean, I think that my from the reading that I did, what's your take on the dollar? What's your long-term take? Wasn't it that the dollar's in trouble long-term?
Well, no. I've said in 2002, when the euro was at 88 cents, I said the euro would go to $1.50, and it went to $1.60.
Yep.
And it'll go all the way back down to a dollar over 10, 15 years. And it looks like, in my view, I think that's what's going to happen. You're going to see the euro and the pound and the yen really go down. The pound's already down 25%.
Yeah, the pound is really, I think, the sleeper of them all in terms of people not really, focusing on the euro so much, and the pound has just been dropping like a rock.
Like it a lot more than the euro has.
Right, exactly.
These are countries that have problems, and their problems are worse than those of the U.S., and we focus on our problems, and we do have very, very serious problems. Our problems are further down the road than the European and the British and the Japanese.
Right.
It's what I call the end game, and I'm trying to write a book on the topic right now called the end game, because we've come to the end of the debt super cycle. And by the end, I mean Greece is there. Portugal's not too far. Spain's not too far behind. I mean, you can only borrow so much, and then the markets say, I'm not going to let you borrow anymore. Japan is getting close. Britain is getting close. I mean, there's a book that everybody should read by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff called This Time is Different, where they look at 266 financial crises over the last 200 years in 66 countries. And in almost every case, everybody says, this time is different. We're different than all of those other guys because, and they have some story to tell. And the answer is, it's never different. Right. There's always a crisis, yeah. And it always ends in tears. You just cannot over-leverage yourself. And that's what we're doing in the U.S., and it doesn't make any difference whether debt is public or private. When the entire group, public and private, becomes over-leveraged, you have a crisis.
Yeah.
And that's where we're headed in the U.S. And so in the U.S., we have a binary option. We can either reduce our deficit over time, say about $250 billion a year, I'm just pulling a number out of the air, and get down to where our debt is less than, our deficit is less than nominal GDP, mm-hmm. at which point we can run a deficit for as long as we care to. It may not be the wisest thing, but we can do it without killing the goose.
Right.
Now, Greece is at a problem. Greece is at a point where they have two choices. They can have a really, really bad choice, which is to start cutting their deficit and throw themselves into a depression, or to have a disastrous choice, which is default on the debt and go into the depression, withdraw from the euro. I mean, they have almost no choice but to go into a depression.
Right. You know how I see it, John?
Because their relative labor costs have gotten out of whack with Germany.
Right.
So, I mean, it all gets connected. The Germans are sitting pontificating, you should be like us. But Germany has become an export power, and everybody can't export their way out of a crisis.
Right.
I mean, we have the same problem in the U.S. We need to export our way out of a crisis, but we keep buying stuff.
Well, that's the whole idea of us finger pointing at China now, trying them to raise the yuan. But let me just go back up for a second. When you talk about this whole the end game, the way I kind of envisioned it as you were talking about it was this: that all of these countries are cars, and the cars are filled up with gas. Some are more efficient than others. The object is to get the car to continue rolling down the road. However, you can do that. But somehow, for some reason, whether it's because the weight in the car, the inefficiency of the engine, the mix of the engine gasoline, the route that you took, or anything of that, for whatever reason, some cars don't make it. They stop. They don't make it to the end. And that's what's happening now. Greece is sputtering. And they're looking for a new tank full of gas from Germany. The problem is, and from the IMF and from the EU, and if they do so, well, then their cars aren't going to be as full for that run, if you will. And that's what's happening.
The problem is, if you help Greece, if you enable them, they're still running huge deficits. Now, if Greece comes in and says, we're really, really, scouts are going to cut this stuff. And so then the IMF or whoever says, okay, we'll loan you the money, but you really got to cut it. Then if they don't cut it, then they've created a problem.
There's no way.
That's not the characteristics that we've seen of Greece. I mean, right. Greece has been in default 150 out of the last 200 years, I think I read.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's what the Greeks do. They default.
And they've gotten rescued, and it's just like a child who, you ever see the parents that do something like this to the child? They're in a restaurant, the kid's acting up, and the parent says, I'm going to count to five. One, two, the kid keeps on yelling. Two, three, four, five, I'm not kidding, six, seven. You ever seen that? That's what's going on.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Greece knows they have everybody by the let's be polite, by the tukas. They got everybody. They know that they can't.
If you're Germany, Netherlands, and some of the more the exporting states, the bigger states are going to have to pick this bill up. The question you do, as you brought up earlier, you've got to be looking over your shoulder at Portugal, Spain, Italy, And the Irish are going to sit and say, wait a minute here, guys.
Yeah.
We have cut our wages by 10%. We may have to do it again. We've allowed our property to drop by 50% in value. We're writing off loans left mm-hmm. and right. We're reducing our expenditures. We're getting our budget under control. And you're going to help the Greeks? And they're not going to do that? Why help the Greeks and not help us? And right. I think the Irish have a legitimate point.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, you have to say to the Greeks, if you want to be a member of the club, you got to pay the dues.
Mm-hmm.
And the dues are running a deficit that's less than nominal GDP. That's the rules.
That would be nice.
I mean, they had this Maastricht Treaty of 3% or whatever, but really, it's you know, just run it under nominal GDP, and you can get away with it. But that's not what they're doing. That's not what they ever did. I mean, it's an interesting thing that to get into the EU, I just read this the other day, you know, because they had to prove that their deficits and so were a particular percentage of GDP, and that they counted, they estimated the underground effects of gambling and prostitution and added that into GDP.
Nice.
In order to make the numbers determining.
See, they're very crafty. No, but you know what? This was not only Greece, by the way. Several other countries. I had a gentleman on about 3 weeks ago. His name is Das, Sanjay Das, and I don't know if you know him, but he'd be a very smart fellow out of Australia. He was he's a bond trader. He was an analyst for many years, many big companies. And he went through all the different companies. I think he calls them the FIBs, France, Italy, Belgium, and Spain. These are not like the pigs, yeah, the fibs, the liars,
mm-hmm.
who came into the EU under false pretense. They came in under, you know, showing numbers that really made no sense only to get in, and that destabilized the region terribly. And I agree with you. I don't want to, you know, kind of kill all of our time on this whole Greek issue, but, you know, there is, I guess, the net effect back to the dollar that, you know, we are that car right now that even though everybody else is kind of looking maybe poorly, we're looking better in the scheme of, you know, not as bad.
Yeah, I mean, the dollar is the worst currency in the world except for all the others.
Right, exactly.
And ultimately, I think, you know where I people come to me and say, where should I put my money that I'm going all short? I tell them, well, okay, the Norwegian kroner or the Canadian dollar, you know, if you're trying to hedge your dollar risk. I mean, it's tough. You can't put it in your very large currencies. And obviously, everybody can't go into the Canadian dollar or the Norwegian kroner. There's just not enough money
right
in those countries.
Yep, yep.
So anyway, we've taken a lot of your time
no, there's great stuff. There's great stuff. Now listen, I want to tell everybody where they can get your information, by the way. Thoughts from the front line, so you can look up that. You can look up John Malden, of course, .com. We'll have all the links on our website so that everybody can get right to you and get your information and all that. I have just two other things I want to talk to you about real quickly. A trend that I see developing, and I don't know if you've noticed this, is this whole idea of increasing dividends and increasing buybacks. Now, you probably don't know about my history, but probably, I don't know, end of 2007 when we started this podcast, I was kind of standing on top of the desk where the microphone is, screaming a lot of times, like, what the heck is going on? I was ranting. I was a lunatic. I was saying these numbers are making no sense anymore. The buying of these mortgages, all the things that you can imagine that were going on back then that were being, you know, shushed by most and that you were probably screaming about as well at the time. But one of the things that I noticed, it hit me again just very recently that this is all beginning to play out like a bad dream again, in that the trend of increasing dividends and at the same time increasing share buybacks, companies are so flush with cash right now because of the mass amount of debt offerings they've done and the refinancing they've done on their debt. And they're so flush with cash that they could do a lot of things with them. But one of the things they'll do is they'll increase their dividends to entice people. And at the same time, they'll issue share buyback programs, essentially negating the cost by the dividend. So the dividends that they give and the taking back of shares, it doesn't cost them anything for the dividend. Do you see this trend as a troubling trend, or is it just I'm kind of getting
Well, I haven't focused on it very much, but I'm more concerned that we're going to start taxing dividends at ordinary income rate, and that's going to be, you know, it's going to double or almost triple in some cases for individuals their taxes that they're paying on money that they're using to live on. I think it's going to be a very negative effect on the markets.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that the Fed seems to be wanting to do is push everybody towards the markets. They're trying to push everybody. I mean, between the Build America bonds and their backing of the municipal bonds, which is just unbelievable. Another, I don't know if you saw this just a couple of days back, we saw another enhancement or elongation of the Build America bonds and of the backing of the municipal bonds and the helping out tax credits to the municipals so they don't have trouble because we know all the trouble they're in. And then the continuation of pushing everybody away from, simple money, CDs. And, I mean, you can't get any money on a CD. You can't get any money on a money market these days. So it's kind of like you're forced to go out and find dividends or better interest-paying instruments. That's why we're seeing this mad rush to issue dividends by companies and to issue debt. As a matter of fact, we saw just last week that several companies are issuing debt these days that are lower cost than the U.S. government, which was kind of interesting, I thought. I think it was Berkshire and like three other companies. You can actually get it cheaper or actually lower yields. But anyway, takeaway, give us this. Give us your kind of your viewpoint from here we are in the end of March. Give us the view to the end of the year. I know it's a long time, but kind of, you know, what are you sensing out there? And then we'll kind of close it up.
I think the economy is going to soften over the next year. We're getting ready between state and local taxes and income taxes in 2011 to increase taxes on the level of about 2% of GDP. With that multiplier of 3%, you're talking about creating a headwind in 2011 of about 3-4% of GDP in tax increases. Because of tax increases, so, you know, which all of a sudden says you've got to be running 5-7% nominal,
right,
just to not be in a recession again. I'm very concerned about another recession.
Hmm. So you think about a double dip? We're thinking the same thing, that there's an inventory restocking cycle. We've been writing about this a lot, and that's kind of pumping things up nicely. Not to mention the government helping out, and then sometime post summer. Of 2010 into, you know, it can obviously last a lot longer, or the delay could be a lot longer. But we're seeing, the potential for, another recession, at least a slowdown in the economy. I think I agree with you with that. I encourage everybody to check out John Malden's information, his books, his writings. I also encourage you, a little teaser, he has a very interesting family. He puts that online. I did check out all of that. Very beautiful family, by the way.
Thank you.
And the other thing that I'll mention is that you need to go and check out where he started and his experience in the printing industry. I'll leave it at that. But go root around his website and find that out. I thought it was a really fascinating discussion of where he started, and it probably would be surprising and enlightening at the same time to see where John started and how he started, and some of his schooling, too. I think that was kind of interesting to me. It was actually a very interesting read, your bio, I must say.
So, well, thank you very much. You're very kind, and it's been good to be with you, sir.
Well, I look forward to seeing you, and we will get together when I'm in Texas and go to your daughter's bar and have a drink. How's that?
There you go. Right. I'm always up for that.
John, I'll see you soon. Thanks a lot. John Malden on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, so what I thought we'd do now is, as I think I mentioned to you, we have a question, and it's regarding currency. Let's listen in, and then I'll try to give it my best shot as a quick answer here.
Yeah, hi, Andrew. Love the show, and I have a question for you. I keep hearing how the Chinese are controlling the value of their currency. How does the country do this? I'd like to know. Thanks. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
All right. So what's happening here is, that's a great question, and we talked about this in the first part of the show of what's happening there. How does a country control its currency? Well, a couple of things. What they're doing is, it's called a peg. They're pegging their currency to the dollar. So think about this for a second. When a country becomes very strong in terms of economics and their economy is really booming, their currency becomes stronger compared to a economy that is less that is more weak or is weaker. So what happens is that if you have an economy that is weaker and you have an economy that is stronger, obviously their currency would reflect that, just in the general nature of their deficits and the surpluses, their overall debt features, etc. So now, if in one country, let's say, is two times stronger, making this very easy, just an easy way to look at this. If one country is two times stronger than the other, you may have a currency that is two times the value and has moved that way over time. and that may reverse, come to parity, and move back and forth depending on the circumstances over time. Now, what China did about a year and a half ago or so is they said, well, they're going to peg their currency to the U.S. dollar, meaning that no matter how strong the current the economies of the U.S. or China get, it's going to keep the parity going. They're going to peg it at the level at that exact moment. So now what happens is China becomes a lot stronger, and their currency is not moving, meaning that technically, because they're a stronger economy and because they're not moving their currency, it makes the products from their country that much cheaper for us. In other words, if they move their currency up, what would happen is that it would cost us more for their products. Well, in an effort to keep their products flowing and their exports flowing at a level that is so dramatic, what they've done is they've actually kept it exactly even with the dollar. A brilliant plan. We call it piggybacking. They're piggybacking us, and no matter how much we try to, you know, get them off and throw them off, they're not allowing it because they want their exports to actually grow. At the same time, because their dollar is not, or their currency is not inflating or moving up in value, it doesn't make for them a desirous to buy anything from us in extreme, because they can buy the same thing from themselves. So hopefully they'll keep on doing what they can to invigorate their own internal sales. Now, the argument is that they let their own currency increase in value, it'd be very good for them because it would increase the value of their currency, and they'll be worth a lot more, and they'll have better internal investment, and more companies and countries will come in and push money into that economy because they'll feel that they can get a better deal on the value of their currency and the inflationary and the growth of that. So in other words, if I buy a piece of land, or if I buy a just the currency of that country, the bonds of that country, in the local currency, and over time that's going to move higher, well, that would be good for me because I get to benefit from it. Now, in a way, Japan is doing the opposite. They're trying to just totally demolish the yen. We saw about 6 months ago, 5 months ago, actually about 5 months ago, that the yen was appreciating as a currency play of safety. And what happened there was their market started going down dramatically because they're an export-driven economy. Their exports were continuing to see a lot of negativity. And even though we saw recently a 45% print year over year on exports, which, by the way, is from the bottom, so let's not get too excited about that. The raw numbers are not as pretty to look at when you look at that over a year basis. And you're not seeing a lot of pickup in demand either on a month-over-month basis. But when you look at the Japanese situation, they're not just simply pegging. What they're doing is systematically trying their best to devalue their currency and make it that much more appealing for countries outside to buy their products. Now, on the other hand, you can see Venezuela that did something totally different. They actually physically went in and devalued their currency. They said, internally, our currency is going to be worth this much when you buy products from our country, but when you bring in exports and buy exports, what you're going to do is it's going to cost you a lot more, thus trying to keep their situation alive internally. And finally, you could do a little bit different of a play where you could do things like tariffs. Tariffs are a kind of a way of manipulating and controlling currency, because it's the actual money that you spend on something, or that is going to be a tax, if you will, on something. So that will kind of shift you from buying one thing or another. Whereas if you want to put a tax, let's say, on anybody that is buying a certain product. So, for example, we put a heavy tax on rubber that was bought from China. Well, we may not want to buy that anymore because it then will cost a lot more, and we'll buy our domestic brands. That is a similar way of adjusting the currency exchange by putting a tariff on a specific product, not on an entire currency. That gives you a little bit of a breakdown. A lot of these things we talk about on the Winning Investor podcast, if you haven't listened to some of the very basic 5-6 minute little spiffs on all sorts of different topics, from EPS and currency issues and ETFs and market capitalization, all sorts of different things. Check it out. That's over at The Winning Investor. And until the next time, we're going to cut it loose here. I'm going to say thanks so much for joining us. We have a great show lined up for next week. We're going to have Frank Curzio in about 2 weeks when he finally moves down to Florida. He can tell us all about that move and all the things that are going on and the stocks under 10. Everybody loves Frank. I was on his show last week, so listen into that. I'll put a link of that on the site as well. Until the next time, keep mailing me your questions, your information. If you want to invest with us, $50,000 minimum, make sure to go right now to the website, look at the 14-minute video. We'll send you the forms, get you started. Never been a better time, in my opinion, to start investing right now, because there's great opportunities, as we see, And I won't give you all of our insight here, but you do also get I'll call it a subscription or access to our client-only blog. And I got to tell you something. I've never felt better with some of the things that we're doing right now. We had a kind of a rough start to January for the markets. We kind of did well with that. Then they moved up, and we kind of stayed stagnant. And right now, though, we're seeing a couple of opportunities that are opening up that could be very interesting. So if you want to invest with us, check it out. I think it's a great time. If you're worried about, I don't want to get in when the market's so high, well, we go short too. So check that out. We'll put that in the show notes, and you can get all the things you need to get started with that, with the Disciplined Investor Growth Strategy, Managed Growth Strategy. Until next week, we'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz signing off on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.